The next case will be at ease till we do 52753, Ritter versus State, with Mr. Carnell. And again, this is Trevenan for the District Attorney of Elko County. Defendant, Mr. Ritter.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, Richard Cornell representing the appellant, Matthew Ritter. I realize that sufficiency of the evidence is not normally a hotbed legal issue before this court, but in this case, I submit to you that there are three hard questions that really the court needs to address in its disposition. First is this: legally, how is this case different or distinguishable meaningfully from Glispie v. Sheriff, 89 Nevada 221? I read Glispie yesterday again, and it seemed to me that in Glispie, the evidence for circumstantial actual possession of Mrs. Glispie was actually, if anything, stronger than it is here, and yet this court found that the evidence was not sufficient to bind Mrs. Glispie over for trial. And I ask, why does Glispie not control the disposition of that issue? Secondly, consider what my client was accused and convicted of doing. He is seated in the backseat of a police vehicle, handcuffed behind his back. Somehow, he's able to bring his hands forward while handcuffed, produce a gallon-size baggie of methamphetamine, put it under the passenger seat in front of him, get it up into the springs, then bring his hands back behind him in the handcuffed position, all the while a police officer, Officer Turnbull, is in percipient view of this and he doesn't testify. And my question is, how inherently improbable is that?
Now, was he handcuffed?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
The argument is he has to be like Houdini to
get his hand say, cuffed. I question whether Houdini could do that. You know, I've run this fact pattern by a number of people, and what I've heard in the light most favorable to the state is up to the point of getting the baggie under the seat, yeah, that could have happened, but then bringing him back behind him? I mean, that's essentially what he was indicted and convicted of doing. I don't see how a human being can do that. And the third issue that I hope that you would address in the disposition that I would respectfully urge you to address is that we know that the Buchanan standard, because this is a circumstantial evidence case, we know that Buchanan applies. How do we explain away the fact that this vehicle was unlocked for a significant period of time between the time of Mr. Ritter's initial arrest on the traffic warrant and the time that Officer Marshawski found the gallon-sized baggie?
Mr. Cornell, yeah, that concerned me. How much time elapsed between the time that Mr. Ritter was exited the police car until these drugs were found?
It's approximately a day, a little less than 24 hours.
The car was in the shop.
The car's in the shop, unlocked for several hours.
Two different shifts also of patrolmen used the vehicle?
Correct. Between, it went... Each patrolman has an eight-hour shift, and it goes Marshawski, and I forget the name of the other two fellows, and then Marshawski again the next day. I would hope that the court would address all of those issues, and I think the bottom line is when the court does so, it has to conclude per Buchanan that it cannot erase the reasonable hypothesis that the drugs got under the seat in some way other than Mr. Ritter putting them there. Even if the court did not do so, as strongly as I urge the court to do so, this case is so weak, respectfully, that I don't see how it withstands any trial error.
What about the bad act testimony?
And that's number one. Okay. That's number one. How do we distinguish this case on the bad act issue from Ellsbury and Taylor on the one hand and Richmond, Pineda, and Whistler on the other? It seems pretty clear to me that per Taylor, 109 Nevada at 854, the fact that Mr. Ritter pled not guilty does not, as a matter of law, put his knowledge into issue such that knowledge can be proven by a prior uncharged misconduct act. It seems to me that that's very clear, and I see nothing in this court's jurisprudence that suggests a contrary result. Secondly, given that, given that the trial issue was not knowledge, it was not that Mr. Ritter admitted he was in possession of the baggie, but he thought something other than methamphetamine was in it, how do we distinguish Ellsbury, 90 Nevada at 53? I submit to you, you cannot. It is error to admit that evidence based on those two cases. I don't see the state in the red brief arguing against that. I see them saying, well, since the evidence came in by stipulation, therefore he waived the issue. How do you get around Richmond, Pineda, and Whistler in that instance then, especially Pineda? 120 Nevada 20809, it seems to me Pineda is preclusive. The fact is, Mr. Ritter made a motion in limine, and that was the judge's ruling. He even renewed the objection in trial, but the judge stuck to the ruling. What he then did is decided, well, or what trial counsel did was decide, well, as long as I'm stuck with these lemons, I'll try to do what I can with them. I'll try to make the best lemonade I can with them. I'll try to present it by way of a stipulation rather than make the state put in evidence. That's a trial tactic, and this court has made clear in Pineda, and I think Whistler and Richmond too, that that does not waive the issue that was litigated beforehand. The simple fact is this evidence should not have come in at all, and I submit to you that this evidence is highly, highly prejudicial. Had this evidence not come in, I submit to you there is a very reasonable likelihood that the jury would have looked at the gut issue, which is exactly what I said before. How does a human being do what I just described and come with the answer you can't? The answer is not guilty.
Mr. Parnell, I'm sorry.
No, please continue. This is your question.
On the dog alert issue in the Sixth
yes.
Amendment, we have a couple dog owners up here, so we wonder how you could swear dogs in and cross-examine them, but we're interested in your...
This is my right-brained issue. I mean, I threw it in because it kind of intrigued me.
Well, we've had it raised before, so I'm interested in your take on
Well, first off, obviously no question that the dog's unavailable for examination. I don't have to tell jokes to get that point across. Okay. Is it hearsay? Well, the argument by me, they just brought in the dog to talk about his behavior. If that were the case, it'd be irrelevant. We're not there to talk about his behavior. We're there to talk about the fact that this dog alerted, and that means that in the dog's opinion, one of three categories of drugs is or recently has been in that car. I submit to you, that's a statement. It's a statement of opinion, and it's a statement.
So you never could use dogs, basically, because it's a confrontation violation. The whole jurisprudence in the United States about dogs are...
interesting point, because the argument would be, well, yeah, but is it really testimonial hearsay?
Right.
Okay. That's really the big issue. Prior to Melendez-Diaz, good argument, and we had good arguments on that between Mr. Lowe and myself both ways in the brief, because what is a dog in a dog alert? He's a police tool that the police bring out to investigate, right? You can say, well, the dog isn't a percipient witness to a crime. Well, a dog wouldn't expect to be examined in a trial, obviously. Okay, fine. But based on Melendez-Diaz last summer, particularly what the Supreme Court said at 129 Supreme Court Reporter at 2533 through 35, I don't think it matters. The fact that the dog is not a percipient witness to the crime doesn't matter. The fact that the dog didn't expect to have to testify in court doesn't matter. The fact that the dog could never testify doesn't matter. I think Justice Scalia and the rest make that pretty clear. If the police were using the dog as a tool and the dog made the statement and the police want to present that against the defendant on trial, it's testimonial hearsay. So that's my argument there. And by the way, that ruling would not eliminate the need for canines and the sniffer dogs. Where canines and sniffer dogs typically come into play is like in my old case when I was in the DA's office, the Latham case. When you have a search and seizure issue that turns on the dog alerting and the accuracy of that, Latham remains good law, and that is the area where canine dogs really matter. In this case, you understand the inherent prejudice of this. What they did was they brought in the evidence of alert to force the defense to explain away that, oh, well, what he was alerting on was marijuana, not methamphetamine. Well, he wasn't charged with possession of marijuana or trafficking in marijuana. So what they did to bring that in was to cause the defendant to present evidence that he engaged in a lesser bad act. Well, it's still prejudicial. It's telling the jury, this guy is a drug dealer. This guy is involved with drugs. It has nothing to do with trafficking methamphetamine.
Mr. Cornell, I'm going to be asking both sides this question. What, if any, evidence was presented at trial that had to do with a showing under the statute, at least my reading of the statute, would require a showing of actual or constructive possession? What, if any, evidence was presented at trial that your client actually or constructively possessed the drugs at issue?
I would submit to you the only answer, that the short answer is none. The only answer that could be presented is the DNA evidence, and I want to talk about that. The DNA expert evidence and the DNA expert did not, underline not, establish a match of the DNA on the baggie to Mr. Ritter. What it established was the possibility that the DNA on the baggie might have been Mr. Ritter's, because it was a very weak sample of DNA and the expert could only apply 2 of 8 areas when there's 13 optimally. And he said that's too low of an area to call it a match. But he also said we can't exclude Mr. Ritter, whereas we can exclude the other police officers. Well, that raises two questions, frankly. Number one, should that even be admissible? It's clear to me it wouldn't be admissible under Rule 702 if we were in federal court. It's clear to me that that kind of testimony wouldn't be admissible in a civil case per Morsicato and the like, because what you're really talking about is a possibility, not a probability. It doesn't assist the jury. Instead, what it does is it makes the jury speculate. And the other problem that we have is, okay, let's assume for sake of argument that weak level of DNA is Mr. Ritter's, the record to the contrary notwithstanding. How did it get there? If it is that weak of an area, don't you think that it got there when the police officers who arrested Mr. Ritter and had physical possession of him then touched the bag? Wouldn't that be a more likely way in which Mr. Ritter's DNA would get there than if Mr. Ritter had the baggie pressed up against his body? The expert, Mr. Riolo, admitted that had the baggie been pressed up against Mr. Ritter's body, you would have had the 13 level of DNA that would have allowed him to make the determination of match or non-match as source. He didn't have that. So that's a long answer to your question, but that is my answer.
Thank you, Mr. Cornell.
Mr. Venan.
Again, for the record, I'm Mark Torvinen from the DA's office in Elko, and you're representing the respondent. First thing I'd like to do, Justice Gibbons, is answer your question about the dogs. And if you think about it, what's really happening when they presented the evidence in this case is that they were presenting expert testimony through the officer as an interpretation of the dog's behavior and not the dog's testimony. Nobody presented the dog's testimony.
I think in other cases, that's kind of how we've looked at it. But
and moreover, I don't think it amounts to much in this case because, the government counsel, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the government presented the issue of the marijuana in the first place. That was brought out on cross-examination. But what was brought out is there was no methamphetamine in there, so it didn't do the government any good anyway. In the trial, I would suggest to you.
Okay. What was your theory to the jury of how Mr. Ritter could have been handcuffed, could have hid this drugs in the police car?
You know, he's sitting in the back of the police car, and they talked about the distance in the floorboards. And this scenario that the appellant advances, that he has to get his hands from behind him, I don't think is necessarily true. All he had to do was get it on the floorboard. His feet weren't handcuffed to his chin. His feet were movable. All he had to do was get it on the floorboard. He was wearing baggy pants. The officer who arrested him, Marshowski, said that he did not search his groin or his butt. And he was there was a time directly after he was arrested when the car was rocking. So I don't the government doesn't accept this concept that he had to get his hands from behind him.
Well, how bulky was this package?
I never saw it personally, but it was described in the record as a gallon bag rolled up.
328 grams of methamphetamine, correct?
Or 397 or something like that.
Yeah, I know what a gallon of milk looks like. I'm not sure what a gallon of
this is.
Powder.
This is baggy now.
Yeah,
it's collapsible.
Okay.
And
Mr. Trevino, I presume that you will answer my question, since I've already indicated that I would like to hear from you. What, if any, evidence of actual or constructive possession of a baggy at issue was presented at trial?
I would. There was circumstantial evidence, and significant circumstantial evidence. Officer Marshowski searched that car before he went on duty. Okay? It was then given to Hildreth.
Hildreth and Shelley, one of the two of them didn't search it, right?
Neither of them did. Marshowski had the habit of sticking his hand up underneath the seat. Neither of those two subsequent officers did.
How about the lady that vacuumed?
She didn't see it either. It was stuck up underneath the very front of it, if you read the record. He had to actually stick his hand up in there and pull it out. But in any event, then the next night, this car had numbers on it, all over it. The next night, he is following this police car the day after his arrest. He's following this police car around. That was before the jury. Then when Shelley got it, he took it to the shop, and the government excluded every other potential, at least during that time frame, that could have touched it relative to DNA.
It was left unlocked for a period of time on the streets
about,
of Elko.
As I understood it was about 2 hours at the city shops. But this is sad. Think about this. We got $15,000 to $40,000 worth of methamphetamine. I guess given those circumstances, and also remember when he was at the police station, when Officer Marshowski, the Sallyport, got him out of the car and he started to search it, Mr. Ritter started declaring to him, "Why are you searching that car? You already searched me." He said this to him. So if you take all these things together, I'm suggesting to the court that there is a compelling circumstantial case, his following this car around, his declarations at the Sallyport, the exclusion of the other people, that there is a compelling circumstantial evidence that he had actual possession of that. And with respect to the DNA, there's two things I want to say about that. The actual testimony before the court at volume 3 at page 411 of the record on appeal, when Mr. Riolo was asked, he said, "His opinion was is that Mr. Ritter, his DNA is there given the frequency numbers that I mentioned earlier," and he goes on to describe the Caucasian, Hispanic, and other. That was his testimony before the court. Now, this is after there was a complete and very, very thorough establishment of his credentials, the theory of DNA, and four different lawyers never objected to this. And so one of the questions, counsel in his opening brief indicated that one of the things that should have happened was that his lawyer should have listened to him. And I question whether or not the argument relative to the DNA is really, in essence, a question about the competency of counsel. And if it is, it's not properly before this court, because that's an issue for post-conviction relief.
So basically, I think your position is that you presented all this circumstantial evidence, the jury evaluated it, and the jury concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed it.
And the evidence of his actual possession of it, clearly the government's theory was is he left it there. And he was in possession of it before it got left under the seat. That was the government's theory. And I'm suggesting to the court that the evidence of that is the circumstances, which are the government suggests are much stronger than has been characterized, if you take them together, particularly his remarks at the jail and following this police car around. And the reason he was following it around is because we're talking about a whole bunch of money.
So your theory was that the police car stopped, he'd run into the car, retrieved the drugs, and
I think he was looking for an opportunity.
So he just did lousy surveillance. He missed that 2.5-hour period where he could have gone in and grabbed it.
Well, it's also the city shops.
But unattended and on the street. You don't debate that. It was not locked behind any gate or anything of that nature. It was nonetheless accessible.
It's the city shops.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting it wasn't accessible, but it just doesn't make sense. Is one of the city employees going to plant $40,000 worth of methamphetamine in there? Well, no. Because if you take that in connection with his following this police car around and his remarks at the Sally Port, it becomes pretty compelling where this methamphetamine came from. Relative to the uncharged misconduct, Your Honors, this court has it has said time and time again that the state is obliged to prove that the defendant had narcotic knowledge of the narcotic character of the substance. It has said time and time again. And relative to Ellsbury, if you go look at the facts in Ellsbury, he testified that he'd done the transaction, the way I read it. And consequently, they said that knowledge was not at issue. Here, that wasn't the case. And what the court said in Fox versus State, 87 Nevada, is that in cases where knowledge is not otherwise established, in that case, they let the prior acts in. And so we have a case here where this is not a case where the government was positing some fanciful defense, as counsel put it in the excerpted from the case he cited, was not making some fanciful argument about that issue so that they could introduce this. It was introduced for that specific purpose, and there was a very, very tailored limiting instruction in accordance with the dictates of Fox, given, I think it was right after the evidence came in. And it wasn't emphasized in argument. If you go and look at the argument, I think there were, volume 3, page 514, lines 14 to 16, there were 8 lines devoted to this, and basically it was a reference in passing that this is the element that the government has to prove, and you heard the stipulation. That was the total reference to it in argument that I could find. So it certainly wasn't emphasized.
Sounds like you've read the John Fields opinion.
Pardon?
It sounds like you've read the John Fields opinion when you.
Well, it's a basic I'm aware of it, Justice
Jerry. As opposed to Linda Fields' opinion.
But this record, there was 8 lines, yeah, and one passing reference. You heard the stipulation, and the stipulation was, I can't remember how many lines it is. It's in the record there, verbatim. It was read to the jury. That was the only reference to it that I could find. If you have any questions, I've
Justice Gibbons, just say any more questions?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Couturier? Mr. Trevine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Couturier, I think you got a couple. We got about 2.5 minutes left. What about him following the car?
What about him following the car? He's driving on Idaho Street, the main street in Elko. If you're going anywhere in Elko, you're inevitably going to be on Idaho Street. What does it mean? The thought of somebody driving to the police station to break into a police station so they can retrieve the seized treasure is crazy. I mean, there's got to be something to support a crazy theory like that other than he's driving down the street near the police station. It just doesn't make sense to me. As I said in the brief, if this were a movie done by Judd Apatow, I could see it. But in this real life, I can't see how that can be.
Well, what about the argument, though? It may be crazy, but it's up to the jury to decide, kind of putting all this stuff together and come to its conclusion.
If that were true, Jackson versus Virginia and the like just wouldn't exist. There are some cases, not many, but I think this is one of them where court has to step and say, no, when you look at what this is all about, 12 rational jurors simply couldn't reach this result. And frankly, the way I think these 12 rational juries reached this result was based on the uncharged misconduct and the other trial error.
So was the evidence of this following the police car, was it on Idaho Street? Is that?
I believe that's correct.
So, which we understand that is the main street of Elko, so it wasn't on any remote side streets?
Or no, 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 no. And as far as the rocking goes, let's take the rest of that evidence. Officer Marshawski noted the vehicle was rocking, but he didn't pay too much attention to that. Why? Because Officer Turnbull was there. Officer Turnbull, a witness who did not testify. What does it mean? To me, it means very little to nothing. I mean, I get back to the same question, and I'll tweak a little bit. How can you remove a baggie of that size, a gallon baggie now, without using your hands and somehow get it under the seat? I mean, is this fellow Pele, too? He's Houdini and Pele? How does he do that? I just can't conceive of how he does that. And on the uncharged misconduct, I want to say this. Based on Taylor, based on Ellsbury, and also based on Honkanen from 1989, I think the approach is we look at what your defense actually is. We don't just say, well, you pled not guilty, therefore knowledge has to be proved, and we can prove it through uncharged misconduct. No, we look at what the defense is. The only category in this case, given that the defense was you can't prove possession, actual or constructive, the only category this might have fit in was identity. But we pointed out in the blue brief why identity wouldn't fall, why it wouldn't hold. The government hasn't traversed that, so I believe, at least the lawyers before you admit, this is not an identity case, that this evidence can't come in to prove identity. So if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer. No, otherwise,
thank you very much, Mr. Cornell. Mr. Carveen, thank you. Interesting arguments, interesting briefs. This case will stand.